This is a lecture by L. Ron Hubbard, given on the 21st of May, 1951. The title of this lecture is Theta Mesh Theory, Part 1. This lecture is 51 minutes long. Reproduced by Golden Era Productions.
The basic definition of Dianetics has been very happily furnished us by Funk and Wagnalls. Funk and Wagnalls put out a dictionary supplement recently, supplement number 5, and it says, Dianetics, noun, a system for the analysis, control, and development of human thought evolved from a set of coordinated axioms which also provide techniques for the treatment of a wide range of mental disorders and organic diseases. Term and doctrines introduced by L. Ron Hubbard, American engineer. From the Greek, dianoitics, kos. Dia is through plus nous, mind, or through mind. And dianetic, adjective. Dianetics is a thoroughly validated method of increasing sanity. If you think of it in those terms, you're not liable to go very far wrong. It's a method of increasing sanity. And it's the only validated method in existence for increasing sanity, unless it's going out and having an awfully good time. Now, it happens that there are many ways to describe Dianetics to somebody who walks up to you suddenly and says, Dianetics, what is that? You say to them, don't do that because it makes you look unsure. Have a good, fast definition. Dianetics is a method of erasing all the pain out of a person's lifetime. You can understand that if a person had no pain in his lifetime, he'd be a fairly happy person, wouldn't he? And they agree. And you say, well, in Dianetics, you just erase all the pain out of his lifetime, and he's well. And it's very interesting, but that's a very convincing definition. That's actually what you're doing. Although I prefer to think of it, actually, in terms, very simple terms, you can convert the pain of a lifetime to happiness and sanity. Now that sounds like bluebirds or something. It's one of those a little bit too Pollyannish definitions, but that's actually what you're doing after all. If you start converting the pain and the anguish of a person's life to useful, forceful thought, you're doing a great deal for him. The methods which have been used up to this time have all been called standard procedure. It's very interesting to hear somebody out in the field say, well, this new method I have of standing the preclear on his head in the corner and auditing him through a megaphone replaces standard procedure. Believe me, if there's any way at all of increasing the efficacy of processing by standing a preclear on his head in the corner and auditing him through a megaphone, that will become part of standard procedure. Standard procedure is a very varying affair. It would probably better be called proven procedure. And it changes. It changes about every 60 days at least. It changes in the direction of less work and thought on the part of the auditor and faster processing for the pre-clear. You know, in the Income Tax Bureau, they have the optimum of one income tax employee for every taxpayer. Well, we're working toward a reductio ad absurdum about like that with standard procedure. In standard procedure, we want an empty chair to be the auditor and 30 seconds to be the entire duration of processing, so that all that Dianetics can do for a person will have been done at the end of 30 seconds with no auditor sitting there. This would be the reductio ad absurdum. Less time, better results, and less intelligence or less application or less understanding on the part of the auditor. When we do these things, why, each time we make an advance, we come close to that goal. That goal is really a very desirable one. I don't think, for instance, that unless we can produce a good release in 20 hours, that we will be able to walk into the federal government and say, now, the contract for releasing all the prisoners that you have, returning them to sanity, and releasing all the criminals and all the prisons and all the psychotics and all of your institutions, and of bringing all of your government workers up into the band of sanity, will be so much ahead. And have the government be very anxious in order to pick up this contract. But if we get it to that level, if it gets into that, it becomes, well, even the Federal Income Tax Bureau could understand it. In other words, we get it to a point where we can forecast the result in a certain number of hours. Now, we can forecast the result now, but it is true that auditor skill is enormously variable. The state of the pre-clear, when you first get your hands on him, that's enormously variable. And as a result, the length of time processing is going to take is very variable. Also, it is actually, evidently, through inspecting the field, possible for a person to go on being processed, well, I don't know, patty cake processing, other processes and so on, just the person lying on the couch and an auditor talking to him or something, and for that person to remain almost static on the tone scale. That evidently can go on for a long time. The auditing that does this has to be so thoroughly incompetent that the Board of Certification probably faint dead away if he even heard five words of it. It'd have to be that bad, but auditors are around doing things that are that bad. Now, this new book is in the interest of communicating a very simple technique, which will then make it possible for the auditor to achieve results on the simplest level, for a better auditor to do more for the case, for a professional auditor, let us say, to do a great deal more for the case. We've got a gradient scale of auditing that can be taken out of this present work. What I'm going to describe unites the basic theory that underlies this. The basic theory is called the theta mess theory. I know there's going to be a lot of you going to have a lot of trouble trying to figure out what a theta mess theory is, but if you have any trouble, it is simply because you're trying hard to make it too complicated. It is too simple. That's the trouble with the theta mess theory. Theta stands for thought. Once upon a time, man talked about his soul. Philosophers have talked about life energy. Some fellow once upon a time talked about cosmic consciousness. All of these things could be called theta. In other words, theta is just the Greek word which comes the closest to saying thought. So let's take thought as a separate energy, as something we don't know a great deal about, but we'll just compartment it out of the physical universe. Now, we know the physical universe. The physical universe is this desk and that chair and that light and the electricity running through that light. Very simple. We've all had our tiffs and bumps from the physical universe. We know about the physical universe. We call that messed. It's called messed because of matter, energy, space, and time. And we take the first letter of each one of those words, and we put them all together, and we have MEST. In other words, matter, energy formed into solids. Energy itself, it could be heat, it could be electricity, it could be any type of energy or any manifestation of energy of which we know in the physical universe. And then there's space. We all know what space is. Space is, it's this empty stuff. And then there's time, what very few of us have enough of. This is the physical universe, and MEST is just another way of saying the physical universe. We could also call it, and get very, very erudite about the whole thing, and call it Phi, P-H-I. And that would be another Greek syllable, that would stand for physical universe. But this starts to sound too much like having to have a label because we don't understand what we're talking about. So let's just call it MEST and let it go at that. By MEST, we mean the physical universe. Now, evidently, the theory of mud to man has not worked out too well. The biologist has said spontaneously arising from the ammonia seas of the world was a form of life which became more and more complicated, and it evoluted and evoluted, and all of a sudden you had a man, and that's all there is to it. And you look at him fixedly and say, yes, but this basic unit of life, or he says, well, that was probably a virus or a monocell or something, and so on. Well, how did it come into being? Well, it just fortuitously came into being. It just happened at that moment there were enough factors present so that they combined and this happened. It's just exactly like that mountain of iron that fell over sideways upon the oil well and somehow or other fortuitously happened to produce a new Cadillac. The odds against the mud demand theory to anyone who wants to figure this out actuarially are so great that when you add to them the odds of this organism going on and getting more and more complex, you get into an imponderable. Men in the past have solved this imponderable by saying, well, God made man and that's all there is to it, and shut up. All right. This we find is a far more acceptable theory, if we want to call it a theory, because we would call cosmic consciousness or something a determination to do something to the physical universe. We find out our first axiom is simply in the line of Theta has as its mission, or one of its missions, the changing of MEST. That's not very complicated. Theta changes MEST. This electricity, as it runs through these wires, lights this light. Life energy changes MEST. A little bit of Theta gets into the physical universe and somehow or other organizes it to turn the laws of the physical universe into a conquest of the physical universe. And Theta keeps doing this, and Theta keeps doing this, doing it. And it builds up a greater and greater control of MEST. The first goal is an organism. It makes an organism, and then this organism eventually has mobility. And then through its mobility, it itself begins to handle MEST and change it. You could say even offhand that Theta did not necessarily want to change MEST creatively. It might also change MEST destructively. But whether creatively or destructively, this energy of thought, which in the past we could liken it to God, God's will, spirit, soul, anything you want to classify it with, except that we know a few more laws than were ever known before about this stuff. Whatever was intended there, it's not necessarily creative in the direction of MEST. But it works out of how can Theta change the most MEST? And you work this problem out, and you find out it can change the most MEST by making a creative organism which can then go on creating things which change MEST. And if we work it out this way, we will see that man has gotten up to a point where he changes MEST. Potentially, man has gotten to a point where he could blow up planets. Now, no other organism can go this high. And we've potentially, actually, could build planets. We've gotten up to that point. Now, theta forms with MEST a union out of turbulence. Evidently, the first step in any theta-MEST combination is a heavy impact of theta against the MEST with a resulting in turbulence. Boom. They don't go together smoothly the first time. Then the theta comes back out of this, or disinterbulates to some degree, and then only begins a harmonious conquest of this MEST which is contact. The theta gets into the MEST, learns something about the laws of the MEST, and pulling back is then able to change more MEST. And then there's another in turbulence and so forth, and theta learns some more and pulls back and then comes in and changes more MEST. Now, whether or not this is in a single lifetime, or whether or not it is in the sequences of lifetimes which go up to make a racial generation of many lifetimes, either way, it's the same cycle that's going on. Each time, this is the same thing. You know, they say that hard knocks are the best teacher. Well, this would simply be the process of an organism's theta going up against MEST. Boom. Getting interbulated, learning something. Fellow gets into a deal and gets swindled. He pulls back out of this deal, and now he knows how to keep from getting swindled. If he's completely hopeless, life uses natural selection on him and lets him get swindled until he is no more. Now, there's a very familiar cycle of theta MEST. Very familiar cycle. The organism is conceived, goes through the cycle of growth, coasts off into a decay, and dies. That is one single cycle. That is theta tackling MEST in one single lifespan. Death is a necessary thing. Unfortunately, you know, this world would look awfully funny if all of the trees of the giant fern area were still with us. And the only way that theta can go on and progressively change more and more and more and more and more MEST is to let the organisms evolve themselves. Now, those fern trees they had back in the Pliocene or the Neocene or the Nylon area were they were useful up to a point. But then more modern tree forms could now evolve. That much MEST had been conquered, and so more modern tree form could be evolved. For instance, to make soil, you have to have lichen and moss. And they make soil out of rock and sand. Well, unless they've been in there together working, you don't have soil which can grow a better tree. Now, these ferns were growing in swamps and so forth, but they were making more soil. They were making also oil for people in Kansas to get very wealthy with, or coal, rather. All sorts of things were taking place there until you got higher and higher organisms and great bodies of fish. They were what made the oil, isn't it? These great bodies of fish, the sea evolved about as far as it could go, and then the land started to evolve. You could see this cycle working. But there's another cycle at work right here in present time. What did you have to eat for supper? There wasn't a single thing you had to eat except the condiments, perhaps the chemical condiments, which were not gained immediately from lower forms of life. In other words, more basic conversion units. You and I can't go out and eat rock. And unlike Nebuchadnezzar, grass stains my teeth. But here we have a necessity for lower forms, living on lower forms, living on lower forms, living on lower forms. And here, in other words, right here in present time, we have an evolution cycle right with us. We have the lesser animals performing certain functions, the balance of nature and so on. And this is a sort of a staff of life. Man, at this moment, happens to be clear out to the end of this staff of life. And we've gotten so far beyond the line that seldom anything eats us anymore, unless it's the government. Actually, a man has pretty well prepped himself outside of this cycle, but it's always waiting for him. He can still be an edible. Now, man will probably keep on evolving out here further, but how did all this lifespan evolve in the first place? Theta made a better organism which could change more mast. But in order to do this, the theta mast had to come together solidly and then separate. Disinterbulate, in other words, and then go in for an orderly conquest. And then get interbulated, then disinterbulate, and then go back for an orderly conquest. That's fairly understandable, isn't it? For instance, the theta, during a lifetime, learns certain things and then dives. The theta evidently doesn't die. Very interesting. It evidently comes back for another attack with another organism. An organism is nothing but theta plus mast. Just that. Organism equals theta plus mast. That's a life form, theta plus mast. But the theta is dynamically trying to change that mast. Now, as long as an organism is progressing, it is following the line and rules and orders of theta. And when it stops progressing, it's because it has been overtaken by mast. This is another way of stating the fact that after a person has gotten 8,622 engrams, he's pretty well done for. Or until he's gotten all of his free life force completely interbulated, he's pretty well done for, unless he's been hit so solidly by some form of mast as to separate the theta and mast in him. All of these factors enter in. We have death, all right? Now, it's an interesting thing that this material slightly violates the biological concepts of the last 150 years. Those are radical. They were brought in as radical. They are still regarded as radical. We are working with factors that man seems to have recognized for the last 5,000 years. We in Dianetics at the present moment are on the most conservative line of thought that we could possibly be on with the theta mast theory. Of course, we've evaluated it. And that is the main improvement on the thing. But it was a wild thought that man came from mud. That was a wild one. But that man came from God or a universe of life which impinged upon this universe, that's an old thought. Man has been playing with this thought that I know of for 5,000 years, and if we can make it work for the first time, we'll be doing very well. Because at this time, with processing, we don't need death. The death cycle is not necessary if a person's theta can be disinterbulated from all the mess in which it has become interbulated, and if we can artificially pull it back out and keep the organism going, the usefulness of the mechanism of death to us as individuals has in some measure ceased, but not wholly. We will, of course, follow along an evolutionary line even further. Probably man's body will evolve a great deal further. Certainly the generations will go along. We say very little in Dianetics about geriatrics. That's a very fancy name for the study of old age and what causes it. We almost leave this alone. And that is very peculiar because I was a member of the United States Public Health Service Gerontological Society. They're supposed to be experts on this. But I've left it alone because it's hard to prove. You have to have had somebody live another 100 years before you can prove much in geriatrics. But if any of you have taken an individual and process this individual very long, you begin to watch actually rejuvenation. There's not much denying this, I don't think. Or you watch aging toward some optimum point of life. What that optimum point of life would be, I don't know. 21, 22, somewhere in there. And you take somebody who has been hung up on the time track at 5 or 10 and who still bears some physiological resemblance to the 5 or 10-year-old, or a person who, God help us, is stuck in birth and bears that rotund shape of somebody who is stuck in birth. You bring those people on up somewhere in the vicinity of their optimum age, unless they have passed the point of no return. Physiologically, the body can go to such a point that no matter how much processing you would do, this person is unable to recover. That point is pretty advanced. A doctor would give this person up, usually, and say nothing could be done for this person. Or, let's say this person is 30 and looks 45. When you process this person, you process them thoroughly and well in the absence of bad physical deformation, you will have somebody who looks 30 or 28 or 26 or 25 or something like that in that range. I'm particularly have in mind one girl in Kansas City when I was up there lecturing. Her husband had just died. And one of the chaps with me processed this lady for 9 hours. The first time I saw this lady, she was sitting there, she looked like an old woman. Of course, she was wearing black, and that didn't help much. But still, you looked at her face. Here was a woman who was obviously about, she looked well along. I kept asking this auditor why he didn't do something for her, because I knew that she must have a heavy grief charge lying right there ready to be blown. So he audited her for 9 hours, and I saw her 2 days after he had audited her, or one day after he'd audited her. Her clothes had changed, which of course helped the illusion a little bit. She was wearing a red dress. Here was a young woman. Here was a young woman. Here was a woman of about 26. This can happen like that. Yes, we very definitely impinge into the field of geriatrics, but we don't dare say very much about rejuvenation in old age. These are very unpopular subjects. Nevertheless, the auditor can watch people get younger or grow up as he processes them. And I, as a matter of fact, very few auditors have practiced very long without having this experience. Now, I'm not trying to sell Dianetics like you would sell these little pink pills that you're supposed to write for. But that's just a byproduct. We're not trying to make everybody live forever. This is just an illustration of the Theta Mess theory. In one generation, then, we have an opportunity of undoing the mistakes of the organism during that generation, recovering the Theta into a free state, which is entangled with the mess through bruises, wounds, collisions, and so forth. Because that's what happens. The primary break of affinity, of reality, and of communication is between theta and mess. The little boy who goes out to play and knocks his shins against the rock. That's a classic example. He has broken affinity with that rock. And if he hits his shin against enough rocks, he will get to a point where mess starts to look unreal to him. This has nothing to do with the word content of engrams. He will not want to have so much to do with mess. He won't want to own so much of mess. In other words, he has withdrawn a little bit his reach into mess. And if he is hurt sufficiently, he will pull his command all away from mess. And what do you get when you get that level? That's propitiation. That's 1.1 on the tone scale. In order to go on living, this person feels they have to give up mess. So they start handing you things. They start saying to people, that they will give them things. They start bribing. They start giving away their mess. This stuff has gotten dangerous. They have had too many breaks, engrams with mess. It's basic theory I'm talking about. We know when we've experimented a little bit with Dynetics, we can take a person down the time track and we can run them into a physical pain moment and they will re-experience the pain, and if we go through it enough times and do a good enough job of it, that pain will reduce or erase. Well, now that is an observed manifestation, but what's the theory behind this? This organism has collided with MEST. That is a primary break of affinity, communication, and reality with that MEST. And the theta. The theta and MEST of the organism then are interpolated within one another. And they have changed their character slightly in that vicinity of that interpolance. Right in that vicinity, they've changed their character by this turbulence. Instead of theta and MEST, they have been jammed together so hard that their polarity has shifted. You might say the wavelength of theta has shifted and the wavelength slightly of MEST has shifted, so that the two of them are now, although they're still very tightly enwrapped, they're interpolated theta and interpolated MEST. We call that for short N theta and N MEST. Now all I'm asking you to do is acquire a vocabulary here of theta, which is the energy of thought from wherever it comes and whatever it is. MEST, matter, energy, space, and time. And interpolated theta and interpolated MEST. We call those N theta and N MEST for short. That's very simple. That engram, then, is a potential point of turbulence because N theta starts to behave in a peculiar way. It starts to interpolate theta in its vicinity. Theta, in reverse, will disinterbulate N theta. You understand? They're the same thing, but they become opposite polarity, so they kick against each other. If a person has a great deal of pain, then that person will pass the pain along to other theta. Let's look at two people who are together, and one is very unhappy, and the other one's very happy, and the first thing you know, the happy person is not quite so happy. This person who's very unhappy could be said to have a preponderance of N theta or interpolated theta. This person's been hurt a great deal in his lifetime. And the person who is happy, we could say, hasn't been. He is not interpolated. And you will find that the person who is happy has become interpolated a little bit by this person who is unhappy. But in the reverse, you will find that the person who is unhappy has become a little happier through associating with the person who's happy. That is theta operating to disinterbulate N theta. Now, that's simple enough, isn't it? So, the N theta tries to make everything N theta. That's its operation. And the theta tries to make everything theta. That's its operation. What are you trying to do as auditors? All you're trying to do is take all available theta in the case and turn as much N theta as you can back to theta again. That's all. And naturally, if you start throwing N theta at this case, you'll increase the N theta on the case. If you interpolate this case more, what little theta this preclear has may become converted in N theta, and then you've got somebody in a psychotic break. Here's a very good example of this. There was a fellow that was operating in Asia Minor a number of years ago, up around Galilee. About all he had to do was to tell somebody to take up his bed and walk or do something of the sort, and this person would come out of almost any illness he was in. That was no myth that happened. Certainly was no myth. And we're not trying to explain Christ scientifically. God help us if we ever went off into that by road of scientific explanations and observations and so forth. All we know is what we compare with the real universe. If that's scientific, that's fine. but if it works, that's better. Now, there's a rather ugly little chapel down South America that has a mountain of crutches outside of it. And people walk into this place, and particularly people who have to use crutches, they walk into this place and kneel down before the altar, usually helped in one way or the other on their crutches, and walk outside again, throw their crutches up on the pile and walk off. There's a mountain of crutches there. It's very interesting. Here you could say, you don't have to, but you could, you could say that here was an area of such concentrated theta that any N theta which came in its vicinity, such as a psychosomatic illness, an aberration, or so on, became disinterbulated. See how that would work? And those people who are using crutches because of some psychosomatic disorder, I imagine they heal up rather quickly. But those people who are using crutches because they have had their right leg sawed off, they don't throw away their crutches. Here you have a case, then, of a tremendous amount of theta automatically disinterbulating a little n-theta. Boom. Now, theoretically, you could actually form a group of people who are sufficiently theta that a newcomer walking into their midst would disinterbulate just through association with these people. Have you ever walked into a happy home and have realized that it was a happy home before you ever talked to anyone? Or have you ever walked into a room and had the strange feeling there's been a quarrel there just a moment before? Or worse, have you ever walked into a room and realized that the people there had been talking about you and not particularly complimentarily before you showed up? You don't have to read the expression on their faces. You can actually sense an atmosphere. This theta is not something intangible. We can feel it. Have you ever looked at a girl, or you ladies have ever looked at a young man, and suddenly realized that you felt a great deal for this person? Just sort of an interchange. I know I was very young one time, and it was spring, and I swear, between a girl and myself, there was enough theta flowing so that it's a wonder that you couldn't hear it crackle like sheet lightning. Never felt so healthy in my life, by the way. Now, here are simple, even homely examples of this great and ponderous basic theory at work. You've sensed it. You know about it. The component parts of theta may be many, but we know three of them. We know three of them. And that's affinity, communication, and reality. You take affinity, communication, reality, put them all together, you get every manifestation of thought that you can think of. As a matter of fact, you can even derive all the mathematics there are from these three things. And that's not a wild statement. I sat down one day and tried to figure out how tensor calculus was evolved, how topology was evolved, how symbolic logic was evolved, each time using only ARC. Affinity, communication, reality. And I found out to have a mathematics, you had to have each one of these. If you had all three of these, you had an understanding or an evaluation or a computation. But if you dropped one of them out, you didn't have. You drop one of them out, you don't have a life either. Now, these three things are interdependent, and one could say that they are the component characteristics of theta. The second that we began to consider it this way, processing and an understanding of processing began to advance at a much more rapid pace. It had to be considered this way because a study of group Dianetics, a study of the third dynamic, revealed to me not too awfully long ago that something had not been codified. I had been going along in the belief, the complete belief, that the third dynamic was nailed down, all taken care of. Well, that just shows how happy and thick-headed some people can get. Because I stood up on a platform one day in California to give a talk on political Dianetics, and I opened my mouth and I said, well, now, and the first time I realized that political Dianetics had not been codified well enough to communicate, and if it had not been codified well enough to communicate, then I could count upon the fact that it was not codified well enough. And I tried to talk for 2.5 hours to people on the subject of group Dianetics. A couple of people from Technocracy were down in the audience. And they said, you don't have that formulated very well, do you? I said, well, you needn't rub it in. I went home and right away tried to figure out somehow, some way, to codify it, communicate it. And I found out that not only did I not have it codified or communicated, but I found out in addition to that, that I didn't know what it was. This was a great surprise and shock to me. My analyzer was a pretty anatem there for a while and said, how wrong can you get? I went back through the original work, original notes, to find out why, and I found out the concentration upon the first dynamic in order to produce processing had thrown aside some of the codifications of the third dynamic. I found out that there were some notes there to the effect. They're in the first book, by the way. The group is actually an organism independent of its individuals. It itself is an organism. Well, how did I get that way? You think it over for a moment, you realize that a group is. You don't really know this till you try to kill a group. You can take individuals out of it. Of course, if you kill all the individuals with regard to it, the group would probably still exist in somebody's memory, or it would probably exist on paper someplace, something. There'd still be inherently, there was something there. The body of the group is not contained in its individuals. It's contained as the group. And until you've tried to kill off a group, as a group, you don't particularly appreciate this. For instance, we've been very involved trying to get rid of California and Elizabeth and Chicago. And they won't die. I just saw a letter down on the desk there, and here's a group of one. And a secretary in Washington, D.C., and he's still holding on to life. I mean, that group won't die. Now, people have been detached away from these things. There's nothing coming into them. Their goals are all knocked aside. But there is a body of theta in existence there which refuses to perish. And the only way we're going to get rid of these groups is by giving them licenses. And they're going to go on very happily. A group is an organism. But what is the organism of the group? And I started figuring it out. It starts to figure out in terms of individuals, and it just does not work. All of a sudden, looking it over, you realize that there is a thought energy. That is also in the first book. It says emotion is a theta. But the thinking had not gone to the point where it could be codified. So all of a sudden, I had to go clear back to when I was studying atomic molecular phenomena back in 1930 and begin to wonder again about thought as an energy, life as an energy. All of a sudden, recodified everything through, got it together, and had theta as an energy which had as three of its components affinity, communication, and reality, and all of a sudden we had group Dianetics. All of a sudden, group Dianetics is a vicious subject. I used to walk in front of a mirror occasionally, and when I'd see myself, I'd wince there for weeks because of group Dianetics. What a monster. I started to test out group Dianetics in California, and it got out of my hands so fast. It was over the hills and far away, and it was running itself, and there was no stopping it. And I tried to say, hey, wait a minute, the way you form a group is, but it had formed. I started to say, a true group is really formed as. It had formed. It had congealed. It was an organism. All of this was just waiting to happen. And the first moment that it was explained to these people what they were trying to do, just the first few rules, and they became so solidly cohesive as a group that it took all kinds of punishment, firings, everything, trying to disperse the California organization. And it's still sort of holding together, in spite of the fact that they don't even have the name Hubbard and Dianetics anymore. They don't have a rights to use the processes. Nothing. This group is trying to hold together. Fantastic. It's so live, and it is so imbued with survival, that if one considers a political organization merely a collection of individuals, he will fail completely to understand it, and he certainly would not be able to do much management of it. A big business organization is actually a group, and that is Theta. The Theta as an energy exists still in a fluid state, but the culture of this group begins to build up with Theta as matter. You understand that Theta as an energy could form into ideas and patterns and technologies, and this would be a culture. This would be the body of the group. And believe me, it's really there. It's wonderful when you start watching Theta Mess work out on the third dynamic. And the only reason I'm talking to you about the third dynamic is the fact that it is so demonstrably accurate in the third dynamic. And you have to fish a little bit before you quite see how it applies in the first dynamic. But once you get it and take a look at it in the individual and see how it functions in the individual, you can process people much more easily. And actually tonight we're talking about the first dynamic. Having formed the third dynamic, an understanding of the first dynamic then became much plainer. What were we trying to do? Were we trying to erase engrams? No. We were converting N theta to theta. And what did an engram do? An engram was an area of N theta. And every time any theta came in its vicinity, a little bit of that theta got turned into and trapped as N theta. And a person's supply, available supply of theta became less and less, but his supply of N theta became more and more. The engram acted as a trap. If a person didn't have any engrams, he could be hit by a lot of N theta and interpolated, but he'd just disinterpolate. There'd be no trap, no hooks to hold on to this N theta and keep it as N theta, as there is when an engram is present. So, it takes an engram to form a secondary. A tremendous amount of grief could be experienced by an individual, or a tremendous amount of fear or even apathy could be experienced by an individual, unless there is a physical pain engram, a solid entrapment below this to hold it in place. It would simply go off, gone. It requires an engram to hold it down. But given enough engrams, the individual can then accumulate locks and secondaries. The bulk of the M theta on the case is not even trapped in engrams. It is trapped in secondaries, moments when the individual has been terrifically interpolated and has been himself in present time very heavily N theta temporarily, and the engram has come up into restimulation, has just picked off a lot of this N theta and has sealed it up. And that is a secondary. And there are your largest deposits of N theta on a case. But day by day, as a person runs into the unhappiness and upsets in his vicinity, he accumulates locks. These engrams become restimulated a little bit, and the person has a little bit of N theta. Situation's not good, not too happy. And a little bit of his endowment of theta turned into N theta will be trapped as a lock. So we get, during a lifetime, we get an individual more and more and more N theta and less and less and less theta. Of course, there are these very heavily endowed individuals who have the happy faculty of being able to compartment off their N theta. You get one of these heavily occluded cases, for instance, no sonic, no visio, no tactile, no present time, no nothing, and this fellow's still functioning. Well, he structurally or otherwise through some ability has been able to compartment off his N theta. He has erected walls, valence walls, circuit walls, whatever you want to call them, and he's left a portion of the analyzer, his thinking apparatus, sufficiently clear so what free theta he has can function there. Now, if you as an auditor came along all of a sudden and tried to tear down those walls, all it would succeed in doing was interpolating the existing theta on the case. And this person would probably practically spin. He wouldn't let you do it. He would resist. It's happening. But if you started to pick up a little bit of N theta here and turn it into theta, a little lock here and a little secondary there and a little something or other there, first thing you know, you've got enough theta so that it automatically knocks down one of these valence walls. So this is the angle of processing. Now, the idea is to get as much theta as you possibly can in the pre-clear. It's too bad we can't put it in with a funnel. It is, because I think actually one of these fine days we may be able to conduit or measure theta. We may know the source, and we may do something about this. Possible. And that's not one of these things, well, anything's possible. It's too easy to observe.